This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
The night sky for February 2016. Well, it's a lovely month for stargazing. The nights are long. We have this wonderful region of the heavens with the constellations Orion, Taurus, Gemini, Auriga, and down below Canis Major, now beginning to move towards the western horizon, but still very visible in the early part of the evening. The three stars of Orion's belt act as pointers up to the right towards the Hyades cluster with the bright star Aldebaran, which lies in fact somewhat in front of it, and then that beautiful cluster, the Pleiades. Down to the lower left of those three stars, one reaches Sirius, the brightest star in the northern heavens, and the brightest star in Canis Major. Over to the left of Orion, one finds Procyon, the only really bright star in Canis Minor. And above that, we have the heavenly twins, Castor and Pollux, in Gemini. High above Orion, there's Auriga, with a rather yellow star called Capella. The line of the Milky Way passes up to the left of Orion and up through Auriga, and some very nice open clusters that can be seen with a small telescope towards the southern part of the constellation. And then as the evening wears on, first of all there's a relatively faint part of the sky, nothing very bright, but it has the constellation of Cancer. At its heart is a lovely open cluster called M44 or Prisipi, the Beehive Cluster. And then, of course, Leo is rising over towards the east. Jupiter, in fact, is lying in the very southern part of Leo. It has a bright star, Regulus. I suppose it's knees, basically, as it's squatted down, effectively, on the ground. So there we go. Quite a number of nice constellations to look for during the evening sky. But what about the planets? You may have known that around the very beginning of February, we have quite a nice lineup of the planets. High up to the south, we have Jupiter, and then we have Mars, and Saturn, and Venus, and Mercury. Mercury won't be very high above the horizon. You'll need quite a good low eastern, southeastern horizon to see it. More of that perhaps later on. Well, Jupiter, it actually reaches opposition, and that's when it's nearest the Sun, and hence pretty well nearest to us, on the 8th of next month. So this is one of perhaps three superb months during which to observe it. It's visible from late evening to dawn. As I mentioned, Jupiter starts the month in the extreme south of Leo, close to the border of Virgo. And in fact, because it's now moving in retrograde motion, it gradually moves slowly northwards and eastwards. The size of its disk increases slightly from 42 to 44 arc seconds as the month progresses, whilst its magnitude again increases very slightly from -2.4 to -2.5. So with a small telescope, one should be easily able to see the equatorial bands in the atmosphere, sometimes the great red spot, and up to four of the Galilean moons as they weave their way around it. Well, Saturn, that's now a morning object. It rises at about 04:30 UT at the start of February, and by about 03:00 UT at the end. It lies in Ophiuchus, near the fan of Scorpius, and about 7.5 degrees above the reddish star Antares. Its diameter is increasing from 15.8 to 16.5 arc seconds during the month, as it shines with a pretty constant magnitude of +0.5. It'll be high enough in the southeast before dawn to make out the beautiful ring system, which has now opened out to about 26 degrees, virtually as open as they ever become. So it'll be best observed just before dawn. It's very sad, though, that Saturn is moving down into the lowest part of the ecliptic. Its elevation never gets above about 20 degrees now, so the atmosphere will hinder our view of this most beautiful planet. Mercury, shining at magnitude zero, lies fairly near Venus during February, and reaches greatest elongation from the Sun on the 7th. It should be visible low in the east for the first half of the month. It lies closest to Venus on the 13th, when it's about 4 degrees down to Venus's lower left. A low eastern horizon will be needed to spot them, as this pair will be less than 10 degrees high, some 30 minutes before sunrise. Mars is lying in Libra, moving eastwards relative to the stars in retrograde motion. Its brightness increases slightly from magnitude plus 0.8 to plus 0.3, as the angular size of its disk grows from 6.8 up to 8.6 arc seconds. It's highest in the morning twilight, and then given a good telescope and excellent seeing, it might be possible to spot the North Polar Cap and possibly Syrtis Major, one of the most prominent of the dark features on the surface. Mars is moving towards opposition on May the 22nd this year. At its closest approach to Earth on the 30th, it will have an angular diameter of 18.6 arc seconds and shine almost as brightly as Jupiter. Venus is nearing the end of a long morning apparition when it's dominated the eastern sky before dawn. It rises at the start of the month as twilight begins, but only an hour before sunrise by month's end. As the angle of the ecliptic to the horizon is small at this time of the year, Venus is especially low above the horizon. But even so, shining at magnitude minus 3.9, it's still easily visible given a good low eastern horizon. During the month, its angular size drops from 12 to 11 arc seconds, but at the same time, the percentage of the illuminated disk increases from 85 to 90%, which explains why the magnitude remains constant. It stays close to Mercury and lies 4 degrees to its upper right on the 10th of the month. But what about some highlights? Well, I've already said it's a great month to observe Jupiter. The features seen in the Jovian atmosphere have been changing quite significantly over the last few years. For a while, the South Equatorial Belt vanished completely. In fact, I show a picture taken by Damien Peach of Jupiter at that time on our website. But it's now returned to its normal white state. The other thing to note is that the Great Red Spot seems to be shrinking. So we'll keep a good eye on that during this apparition. But it's getting on towards half the size that it was observed to be some years ago. I give a list on the Jodcast, the Jodrell Bank website, which gives you the times when the Great Red Spot, perhaps now not quite so great, is in fact facing the Earth during the evening. So that's a good time to have a look at Jupiter. On the 1st of February, before dawn, we have Mars and a third quarter moon. They'll be seen, if clear, due south. And as I've said, as it nears the Earth, we may begin to see some details on its surface. And I should point out, as been in many of the papers, there's quite a nice lineup of the planets before dawn. High up in the south is Jupiter, then we have Mars, and then Saturn, and then Venus and Mercury. So in the first few days of February, why not get up a bit early and have a look? Again, on 6th of February, just before dawn, the very thin crescent moon will lie above Venus and Mercury, looking towards the southeast. You may well need binoculars to spot Mercury, but please don't use them once the sun has risen. Quite a nice event on the evening of February the 13th, when the moon is going to occult the 4.4th magnitude star Xi 1 Cetae. And the nice thing is, it occults it with the dark side, the unilluminated disk. So the star is seen to disappear in a twinkle of an eye, perhaps. And that's around 1920. And it will reappear below the moon's illuminated disk at around 2019. Now, I said around because due to the fact that the moon is not that far away from the Earth, the timings that I've given on the chart on the Night Sky website will vary somewhat across the UK. The timings I gave were for Manchester, which you could say is roughly halfway from the south to the north. I know they say we're in the north, but we're not really. On the 14th of February, the moon passes close to the Hyades cluster, not quite as close as last month, but it's quite a nice photo opportunity. And you see that red giant star Aldebaran shining at magnitude plus 0.8. It's not part of the Hyades cluster, but lies partway towards it. On February the 23rd, the moon is close to Jupiter. The moon will be near full and pass down to the right below Jupiter during the night. And I've given the diagram of the relative positions at about 9:30, a good time to have a look. And also, on the same diagram on the website, the positions of the Galilean satellites. Nicely spread on either side. So just put night sky, Jodrell Bank, into a search engine, and that will actually bring up the page. I try usually each month to give something to look for on the moon, and this month I've chosen the Hyginus Rill. For some time, there was quite a debate as to whether craters on the moon were caused by impacts or volcanic activity. I remember Patrick Moore saying that it was volcanic because all the craters were actually round. But in fact, the impacts are so fast, they're called hypervelocitic, that the object burrows down beneath the lunar surface and then effectively explodes. And so unless the angle of attack is very shallow, perhaps less than 15 degrees, the craters will actually appear round. Anyway, it's thought that the Hyginus crater, which lies in the heart of the rill, is possibly volcanic in origin. It's an 11-kilometer-wide rimless pit, in contrast with impact craters that have raised rims. And its close association with the rill of the same name associates it with internal lunar events. It can be quite easily seen to be surrounded by dark material. It's thought that an explosive release of dust and gas created a vacant space below, so the underlying surface collapsed, forming the crater. Anyway, I wish you a good month, and hopefully with some more clear evenings than we've seemed to have had in the north during January.
Thanks for that, Ian. And now for our Antipodean listeners, here's Haritina Mogashanu with The Night Sky Where You Are.
Clear skies from Space Blessed Carter Observatory in Aotearoa, New Zealand. My name is Haritina Mogashanu, and tonight I am your storyteller from the Southern Hemisphere. Getting to know the southern sky is a wonderfully strange experience. In any new place that I visit, I always feel grateful for landmarks. On Earth, I am looking for trees and buildings and mountains. In the sky, I always look for the brightest stars. Here in New Zealand, there are places and times when the light of the individual stars is lost in the haze of the Milky Way, as if a blanket of tiny lights is covering the Earth at night. Not this time. This time of the year, we're very lucky to see the brightest stars in the evening sky, and a bonus for this year, something that hasn't happened since 2005, is that the planets are aligned in the morning sky. And even if you are not a morning person, it's worth waking up for that. Let's start with the evening sky as you do. The sun's winter wife, Hinetakurua Sirius, is the brightest star in the sky, reaching the sky's peak at nightfall to the north of the sky's highest point, the zenith. Left of Takurua are the stars of Tautoru, or, as we know them from the Northern Hemisphere, Orion's Belt, Al-Nilam, Al-Nitak, and Mintaka. Mintaka is located precisely on the celestial equator, which is the projection of Earth's equator in the sky. This means that it rises perfectly due east and sets perfectly due west, a great companion for celestial navigation. To Kiwis, Tautoro makes the bottom of the pot. There are a few pots and pans in the New Zealand sky, and the cuisine here is delicious, so pots and pans figure strongly in New Zealand's astronomy too. One important pot contains Orion's belt, and its sword is the handle of the pot. Above the pot, or Tautoro in Maori, at a distance somewhere between 700 and 1,700 light years from Earth, it's the glistening blue giant Puanga, or Rigel, another very bright star. Actually, Rigel is the seventh brightest star in the sky. About 10 million years old, it is still burning hot at 12,000 degrees in the constellation of Orion. Remember that the modern constellations are only patches in the sky, similar to countries on Earth, although they have kept the names given long ago to the asterisms that inspired their creation. There are 88 such patches covering the entire sky. One of them is Orion. The dot-to-dot shapes that we make from stars are called asterisms. Asterisms can be inside of a constellation, like the pot is inside Orion, or they can stretch over many constellations, like the Māori Waka o Tomariri stretches across 270 degrees over the Milky Way in November. Another example is the ancient asterism of Argo Navis, which today is made of Carina, Pupis, and Vela. Back to constellations, by convention, the brightness of the stars in a constellation is noted with the letters of the Greek alphabet. Alpha for the brightest, Beta for the second brightest, and so on. And just like for countries on Earth, if the people of New Zealand are called New Zealanders, according to this convention, the name of the specific star identified by a Greek letter is followed by the genitive form of its parent constellation's Latin name. For instance, Alpha Orionis means the brightest star in Orion. This is something that astronomer Johann Bayer invented long ago to help him map the stars. But as there are always exceptions, here is one. Although Rigel is the brightest star in Orion, its Bayer designation is Beta Orionis, which means that when Bayer was compiling his famous atlas, Uranometria, in 1603, Rigel was perhaps not the brightest star in Orion, but the second brightest. Many years have passed since then, but Rigel has kept the name of Beta, even though it is now officially the brightest star in Orion, and sometimes historical conventions or events are more important in the grand scheme of things. However, for me, it is important to understand why we stick to them even when they don't make too much sense. In stellar navigation, Rigel is also a very important star. Old records name it Marinus Aster, Latin for maritime star. No surprises why that was, since Rigel is bright, easily located, and equatorial, which means it is near the celestial equator, the projection of our own equator in the sky, and this means it is also visible all around the world's oceans. Its declination, the celestial equivalent of latitude, it's minus 8 degrees. That would be like saying 8 degrees latitude south if it were for a town or a city on Earth. So, Rigel cannot be seen from latitudes north of 82 degrees. That is about 8 degrees from the North Pole. Splendor and honors were attributed to the lot of these born under Rigel, according to the ancients. Opposite Rigel, on the other side of Orion's belt, more precisely below it, as seen from Wellington, New Zealand, Pūtara, or Betelgeuse, a shining red giant, or more precisely a supergiant, is the ninth brightest star in the sky. Betelgeuse is the second brightest star in Orion, and it's located at about 600 light years away from us. Betelgeuse is a mistranslation of the Arabic name, which I will not even try to pronounce, but it means the armpit of the central one, or, according to some other people, Orion's hand. It is part of the famous winter triangle of the northern hemisphere, and for the ancients, Betelgeuse brought fortune, martial honors, wealth, and other kingly attributes. Betelgeuse is visible to virtually every inhabited region of the globe, except for a few research stations in Antarctica at latitudes south of 82 degrees, that is, within around 8 degrees from the South Pole. That is, because, just like Rigel, the declination of Betelgeuse in the sky is almost 8 degrees, but on the other side of the equator. If Betelgeuse would be a city on Earth, it would be located at 8 degrees latitude north. Both cities of Betelgeuse and Rigel would share the same meridian, which in the sky is called Right Ascension. Even though it is just a tad younger than Rigel at about 8.5 million years old, Betelgeuse is a dying star approaching supernova, which is estimated to happen within the next 100,000 years. Its end is near. Betelgeuse is also known as Alpha Orionis, although it is now the second brightest in the constellation after Rigel. And it was indeed noted as a much brighter star than what is now observable. Betelgeuse, together with the two dogs, Sirius the big dog, and, on the other side of the Milky Way, Procyon the small dog, make a beautiful triangle, which obviously from New Zealand is upside down, but still pointing at Taumata Kuku, the Hyades, which are forming a mathematical less than shape in the northwestern sky, as seen from Wellington. Lower down, the Tafiti, the Shining Ones, or the Pleiades star cluster, prepare for their trip to the underworld, soon to disappear behind the sun. We will not be seeing them from March until the end of June, when they will reappear just before the sunrise, but they will be called a different name then, Matariki. Unlike us Europeans, who, once we name a pattern of stars, we keep it at all times of the year, the Southern Hemisphere is very fluid in this respect, and I have learned that the Maori have different names for the same stars at different times of the year. Mostly, these combinations come in threes. I have wondered why, and then realized that as the Earth goes around the Sun, the sky visibly appears to change from season to season. That is, if you compare it at the same time of the night throughout the year. So for the Maori, making different combinations in the sky according to the season was a great way to lock this knowledge into a different form of a calendar. In fact, if you watch the stars in the sky all night long, you will see that they behave just like the sun. They will drift westwards throughout the night. Of course they do. It is not them, it's the Earth spinning around. But unlike the sun, if you watch carefully, you will notice that every night the same stars, if you look at them at the exact same hour and minute as the previous night, they would seem to have shifted their position also westwards, just a tiny little bit. For us on Earth, this change is very visible from month to month and especially from season to season. This is why I believe that the Maori had seasonal names for their different groupings of stars, because the same shapes are repeating every year. Stars make a great seasonal marker, especially for their particular culture, which was created whilst navigating the seas and oceans. Compare that to landlubbers like myself, who always had nature and plants and landmarks to guide ourselves by, and who often experiences four very different seasons. Once we had named a constellation or an asterism, its name would stay the same throughout the year. Not so for the Maori. No wonder why our views of the skies are so very different. People of old did not have such detailed information about all these celestial movements and imagined that those stars, just like the plants in the winter time, for those who had winter time, would go to the underworld for a while. Perhaps that's the reason why the reappearance of the Pleiades in the sky after a long absence is associated in many cultures with dead ancestors. So how about the next time you look at the sky, you choose a star and a signpost, like a street lamp or something, and watch that star at exactly the same hour of the night throughout the year from exactly the same observation spot. I too have one such spot, and I call it the center of my universe. From my center of the universe, south of the zenith, here in New Zealand, radiant Atutahi Canopus, it's the second brightest star in the entire sky. A circumpolar star, Atutahi Zenariki, the chief of the stars. Another constellation that is circumpolar to Wellington is the Southern Cross, visible here at this time of the year from 9 p.m. Coincidentally, the Southern Cross will be easily located roughly at the same hour, 9 o'clock, on what I call the Grand Clock of Heavens. This is the area of the sky starting from around minus 60 degrees declination, to which Canopus belongs as well, and Alpha Centauri and Beta Centauri and the Southern Cross. Now, looking at the circumpolar stars from New Zealand, you will notice that they seem to progress on the sky clockwise, which makes that region of the sky look even more like a clock. Within the Grand Clock of the Heavens, the large and the small Magellanic Clouds are two nearby galaxies visible to the naked eye south of the zenith. They are so prominent in the sky that the first time I spotted the large Magellanic Cloud, I simply believed it was a Cirrus cloud, biased by my Northern Hemisphere image of how a galaxy should look like. Imagine my awe when I realized what I was looking at. And if you wonder where our galaxy, the Milky Way, disappears, as we can only see a very few bright stars in the sky at the moment, well, actually, it hasn't gone away. It is well known that in New Zealand, there are times when the Milky Way stretches as a band of stars from north to south going through zenith. This is one of those times. At dusk, around 10 p.m. in New Zealand, since now it is still summertime and the night falls very late, the band of the Milky Way comes up from the northern horizon where Capella is hiding below it, then arches through Betelgeuse, Sirius, the Southern Cross and its two pointers, Alpha Centauri and Beta Centauri, where it is at its brightest, and then descends to Earth through the south. But during this time of the year, we are looking towards the outskirts of the Milky Way, especially when we turn our gaze towards Orion. Thus, we see less stars in the sky than when we are looking towards the center of the Milky Way. Within the Milky Way, stretching as an arch high across the sky, its brightest regions are well positioned for observing up in the sky away from the atmospheric haze of the horizon. So let's turn our gaze south of zenith to the ancient constellation of Argo Navis. Argo Navis lies entirely in the southern celestial hemisphere, which is the part of the sky south of the celestial equator, the projection of Earth's equator in the sky. Even though it is called the southern celestial hemisphere, because the sky is really huge, we can see most of it from anywhere in the world, a part of the regions of the sky covered by the Earth itself. Argonavis can be found east of Canis Major, south of Monoceros and Hydra, largely in the Milky Way, covering a great extent of the sky, almost nearly 75 degrees in length and containing about 830 naked eye components. Modern-day astronomers have divided Argonavis into three constellations, Carina the Keel, Pupis the Stern, and Vela the Sail. No bow. The ship is said to be moving stern forward. The Naut of Argonaut and the Navis of Argonavis come from the same Indo-European root nau, which means boat or ship. We constructed many of our modern words from this ancient termination. Aeronaut, aquanaut, astronaut, cosmonaut. Of the three constellations that made the ancient Argo, Pupis marks the stern. Inside Pupis, two less known Messier objects, M46 and M47, are revealing their beauty to Southern Hemisphere observers. Messier 46, also known as NGC 2437, is an open cluster at a distance of about 5,500 light-years away. Approximately 500 stars make the Young Cluster, which is thought to be only around 300 million years old. This is a very young age for some stars. There is also a planetary nebula, NGC 2438, near the cluster's northern edge. But that's not a planet at all. A planetary nebula is an expanding glowing shell of ionized gas ejected from old red giant stars late in their lives, as the outer layers of the stars are expelled by strong stellar winds. Messier 46 open cluster is located close by Messier 47, another open cluster, which is about 1 degree west in the sky, so the two fit well in a binocular or wide-angle telescope field, like two close sisters, a name to which they are often referred. Messier 47, or NGC 2422, was considered for a while the lost Messier object, as the coordinates indicated by Charles Messier did not reveal anything for a long time. Rediscovered independently as NGC 2422 by a Canadian astronomer, T.F. Morris, who had the realization that the two were the same thing, M47 lies at a distance of about 1,600 light-years from Earth, with an estimated age of about 78 million years. There are about 50 stars in this cluster. And if the evening sky belongs to the brightest stars at this time of the year, the morning is a regal of planets. Jupiter comes up at dusk, shining brightly with a steady golden light. It will be in the sky all night long. Until 20th of February, the bright planets are forming a magnificent alignment before dawn. Golden Jupiter looms in the northwest sky. Reddish Mars climbs northeast of the zenith, while creamy Saturn is midway up in the eastern sky. Brilliant Venus adorns the eastern horizon, and Mercury shimmers below and to the right of Venus near the horizon. The next occurrence of the kind is in August 2016, and then not again until 2018. So to see it, all you have to do is to wake up before sunrise. I found this beautiful writing of the ancient poet Aratos. Stern forward Argo by the great dog's tail is drawn, for hers is not a usual course. but backward turn she comes, as vessels do when sailors have transposed the crooked stern. On entering harbour, all the ship reverse, and gliding back on the beach, it grounds. Stern forward thus is Jason's Argo drawn, Canopus at its helm. Thank you for listening to the February 2016 podcast. Until next time, kia ora and kia kaha from Space Place at Carter Observatory in the Southern Hemisphere.